Welcome to Science in Action from the BBC World Service with me, Roland Pease. Now, we all love a huge, scary organism from the past. So this week we've got two. A giant tadpole from the age of the dinosaurs.
For me, it was amazing to have the first proof that metamorphosis was present in the ancestors of frogs and toads.
And a copse of trees that is a single, still living plant that survived the Ice Age.
Currently, we think it's between 10,000 and 80,000 years old.
And to top all that, the genes recovered from Pompeii that rewrite the history of its inhabitants.
I think these casts for a long time have really been even a little bit exploited as a vehicle for storytelling.
Let's start with lab experiments with coronaviruses, which are supposed to help scientists understand their life cycle and get a better idea of which of the thousands out there in the wild might threaten another pandemic. But experiments which will also doubtless reignite doubts about the wisdom of working on these viruses in the lab at all. As I've described many times in the past 5 years, SARS and SARS-2 viruses start their replication cycle by invading our tissues with the help of ACE2 proteins, which are found all over our bodies, there to help regulate our blood pressure. It's just they get hijacked by the virus. MERS coronaviruses actually use a different protein receptor, and in fact, with many coronaviruses, it's not clear at all how an infection can start, which is in itself a block to cultivating and studying them in the lab. So teams in Wuhan and the University of Washington in Seattle have found a way around that block by engineering synthetic receptor proteins, which they can incorporate into their lab tissue cultures, making them susceptible to novel coronaviruses. It sounds clever, but is it? And is it wise? Cambridge virologist Ravi Gupta came on the programme many times during the pandemic as SARS-2 shape-changed and became more infectious. And he's back again to help. Ravi, my picture is this viral invasion starts when one of these receptor molecules breaks open Spike. And it's a bit like one of those Transformer toys. Spike unfolds to reveal all the bits inside, which will then find the way through the cell membrane.
Yes, absolutely. That's a good analogy.
And so this new work is to make synthetic proteins which will do the same.
That's right. They've used knowledge they gained from studies with antibodies, in fact. They noticed something very special, that some antibodies to the spike protein can bind the spike, but then make the spike undergo this transformer-like change, even though it's an antibody binding and it's not binding the cell surface to get inside a cell, but the antibody is able to recreate that scenario. And then they were able to, of course, figure out what it was about the shape of the antibody that enabled those series of events to happen. And, of course, they realized that if they could make more of these or design these against different viruses, they could then insert those antibody-like structures into cells on their surface, and then the virus will bind, you know, that protein scaffold, they call it, and then that will trigger those events and allow cell entry. So they extended their initial findings to design through structural studies, and then they sort of custom make proteins that fit the shape of the spike protein, and that is part of how they designed these receptors.
So even though these spike proteins that the viruses have are always a bit different, there's enough that sort of, there's a pattern of how they do these things that is the clue for these researchers as a way to sort of unlock them.
Yes, there are particular sort of signatures or structures that are common, but there are differences as well. And that's what makes the different sort of cell receptor target profile. So they use the structures of the spike proteins to design a number of different possible scaffolds or receptors, and then they test the ability of those different ones to enable entry. So I don't think it was just that they were able to get it first time. They had to do some trial and error to figure out what was working and what wasn't.
And so then, having invented these artificial, these synthetic receptors, they then have to incorporate them into their cell cultures. So it may be some sort of liver cultures or lung tissue or something like that that they can incorporate it into. They then get the coronaviruses and they can see that they do infect them. Is that right?
That's right. They will be able to get what we use cancer cell lines in the lab. You can then make those cells produce the particular receptor scaffold that you've designed, and then you can show that the particular virus you're looking at can actually go inside the cell and make copies of itself.
It sounds clever to me, but I'm not quite sure what the end game then is. Why does this help understand actually what kinds of threats a particular coronavirus might be?
So it kind of goes back to the fact that we can't study viruses very easily unless we can get them to infect cells in the lab. And once we can get them to infect cells in the lab, we can then understand the life cycle, we can understand the vulnerabilities of the virus, and we can test drugs and therapeutics against those viruses.
So that's the cleverness of it. What about the wisdom of it? You've been part of a project called the Pathogens Project, which I think is quite concerned about so-called gain of function experiments, where basically you're taking things which are not getting into lab cultures and into lab animals, making them get into there, and then that might be the start of some kind of lab leak down the road.
So that's right. We were discussing the framework under which experiments on viruses should be undertaken, and the consensus was that, of course, gain of function is a term that's kind of been misused, because we do gain of function work with all kinds of organisms all the time to give them properties that are very beneficial for human health. The key question is, are you making the virus do things it doesn't normally do and which have a risk to humans in terms of becoming more pathogenic or more transmissible and dangerous, essentially? So that's what we've recommended is that there is oversight and regulation of such work to determine what the risk level is. Now, for this kind of work where you have unknown viruses and you're making receptors for them, this work would undoubtedly, in my view, come under the sort of higher risk category, and you would need to do it in facilities such as containment level 3 or 4, where stringent measures are taken to ensure that the pathogen is very well contained. So most of the accidents that you may have heard about or we read about have happened where people have unknowingly experimented with pathogens in the wrong containment level. In other words, they've not been experimenting in the relevant safety environment. So with this sort of work, it would always be in the highest level of safety.
Even though the virus itself has not been changed, and so there's no change of function on the virus itself, the sort of the system which includes the cells you've infected has been altered. And I noticed Science magazine in its reporting says that there are people who just wonder whether this is a wise move, you know, given the balance of making something that couldn't infect a cell into something that can infect a cell, and the knowledge you might learn from that. Where do you stand?
Well, I mean, all of these viruses can infect cells. It's just that we don't understand the receptors that are used. So in the wild, they'll be infecting, you know, animals all the time. And a subset of these will, you know, have the potential to jump into humans. I mean, what this work does do is enable us to maybe predict the risk of, you know, human transmission of many different viruses. And that actually would be a benefit for human health and global public health. In other words, understanding what the threat level is of different viruses. And then maybe once you have that, you can then instigate relevant measures for protecting the public. So I think that the technology itself or the approach is overall of benefit to human health, although I do understand that there may be concerns, but these need to be managed in a sensible way. I think stopping scientific research that could benefit us is something that should not be undertaken lightly.
So a qualified thumbs up from virologist Ravi Gupta for that inventive coronavirus work, which was reported in the journal Nature. Vesuvius, when it erupted in the year 79, famously burned and entombed all before it in the coastal city of Pompeii. Steadily uncovered since the 18th century, Pompey now makes a haunting tableau of life in the Roman Empire at its peak. The houses, the possessions, the decorations, and some of the victims who could be recognised by the hollows left in the hot pumice as it rained down around them. By filling in those hollows with plaster of Paris, 19th century archaeologists captured that moment of death for those poor victims. And those casts are part of the chilling display that visitors have seen since. The work also incidentally captured fragments of bones, and restoration work in the past decade has given geneticists in Italy and at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Germany a chance to recover traces of DNA from them to yield a more intimate picture of the volcanic victims. Alyssa Mitnick of the Max Planck Institute is one of those geneticists.
The sampling process was during a reconstruction or restoration effort of these casts, because many of them have been damaged over the decades, for example, during the Second World War. And yeah, during this process of documenting the casts, we were able to take bone fragments that were embedded within the plaster from the parts of the casts that had been damaged. Some of the famous examples where we were able to generate genetic data for is, for example, the group of four individuals from the House of the Golden Bracelet, which were two adult individuals and two small children. And one of the adults was actually holding one of the small children on their lap. And this adult was also wearing a very intricate golden bracelet. That's why the house is called so. And this group was then often interpreted as a mother holding her child with the father and the other child nearby. And then we were able to show that this is indeed a group of four genetically male individuals, and we couldn't find any close genetic relationships between them.
That is so interesting. I suppose people arrive at these places with their own sort of prejudice, I guess. But so they weren't even related, are you saying?
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose what really astonishes me is that you were able to retrieve any DNA at all from these fragments, because, you know, these were scorched individuals. They went through a horrible death. How hopeful when you started this were you that you might be successful?
Yeah, it was quite experimental going in. We weren't sure if we would at all be able to retrieve any DNA. Notoriously, warm regions such as the Mediterranean aren't really conducive for long-term DNA survival. And on top of that, of course, the extreme heat event that the Vesuvius eruption was would have also contributed to that. So we were very happy to see that for some of the individuals we sampled, at least, we were successful.
So, as I say, remarkable. The mother and child who weren't, in fact, mother and child, is one result. The other one I found very interesting is you were able actually to get an idea of where these individuals came from, which is far more wide across the Mediterranean than I guess I'd expected.
Right. So we used two methods to estimate these people's origins. One was their genetic origins. So we analyzed their relatedness to various populations, worldwide populations, to see where their ancestors might have originated. And we also looked at stable isotopes. So these inform about where a person grew up, where their...
It's a kind of atomic analysis of the soil that they would have been near, or the water.
Exactly. It's taken up through food that was grown on that soil. And so the genetic analysis showed us that these people were most closely related to the contemporaneous populations of the Eastern Mediterranean, like Anatolia and the Levant and Northern Africa. And this really mirrors what we know, for example, the city of Rome, where we see this large genetic diversity during the Roman Empire that really points more towards Eastern Mediterranean influences.
I guess, this was an empire, and Pompeii is, you know, on the Bay of Naples. It's a port city, so I guess you'd see huge numbers of people coming through over the centuries.
It's maybe not necessarily surprising that we see this in a port town as Pompeii, but it's it's still quite interesting because compared to Rome, Pompeii is a much smaller city.
Are there more samples you hope to get maybe in the future? Or
yeah, there are just over 1,000 individuals that were excavated in Pompeii, and only about 100 or so were made into casts. So there are many skeletons that are not displayed as casts.
You're encouraged that this is actually a worthwhile effort.
Yeah, indeed.
Your labs are famous for the sort of reinterpreting human history through the DNA from very, very ancient bones going back tens of thousands of years. But most of those are sort of anonymous, whereas here you're working with ones who, in a way, we'd know some of their story. Does that make it different?
Pompeii is, of course, famous for the different kinds of stories. I think more than any other site, this brings modern people closer to ancient times and the actual like lived history and the daily life of people. I think these casts for a long time have really been even a little bit exploited as a vehicle for storytelling. And it seems respectful to kind of bring a little bit more truth about these people to light.
Alyssa Mitnick rewriting our picture of Pompeii in the journal Current Biology this week. There's a link to her work on the Science in Action webpage, which you can find at bbcworldservice.com. Genes are taking us further back in history now with a stand of trees in Fish Lake National Park, Utah, that are technically all one organism, all sprouted from a vast network of roots underground, which has lasted since well into the last ice age. It's called Pando, Latin for I spread. With an estimated 47,000 stems and weighing perhaps 6,000 tons, it's said to be the most massive organism on the planet. And it's probably the oldest one too, at least that we know of, according to a new study using genetic mutations in the many stems as a proxy for the time it's survived. Rosen Pino is the biologist who took on this mammoth task.
It's really wonderful. It's about 2,700 meters in elevation, and it's all really dry. It's by a lake, and so when you get there, you actually cross through the pendoclone because they built a road in the middle of the pendoclone before they knew it was such an interesting organism. So it's like in the mountains. It's very nice, very pretty, very rocky. Lots of aspen.
And from the ground up, it just looks like an ordinary forest grove.
Absolutely.
But underneath, it's completely different.
Yeah, exactly. Aspen, and like many plants, is particularly interesting because it can reproduce through the root system. So once one tree has grown, it can send roots through the ground. And from these roots, new trees can grow. And so they're all the same genetic background. So they're all the same technically individual, and they can spread through the roots like this, a large distance.
And each of the individual trunks and branches that I would think is an individual tree, they might be, what, 20, 30, 100 years old or something like that.
Yeah, we think they can live up to 150 years old at most. But the root system stays underground, and from the root system can grow new trees such that the whole organism, so the whole population of trees as a whole, can be older than its parts.
I understand that it's always been regarded as very old, but you've gone back there to make sure we knew how old it was?
So we had estimations of how old it was, but mainly based on the last glaciation age and its size. So it was nothing really thoroughly identified before. And so we have kind of used a molecular clock to try and age the organism for the first time.
So you're the first to look at, the, as it were, the genetics and say that different parts of the plant will have slightly different genetics, and that will be related to the slow accumulation of mutations.
Yeah, exactly. So every time our cells divide, they replicate their genetic information. And so every time we replicate, there is a risk for making a mistake, which is what we call mutation. And we can gain information about how old an organism is based on how many of these errors we find.
I mean, do you know how fast these mutations grow up? Because presumably that's the critical part, is how often you get a mutation.
Yeah, exactly. We have an estimation of the mutation rate. So per generation, we already have this estimation. And that's how you can convert the number of mutations you have to an age in years.
So your conservative estimate is that it's at least 16,000 years old, is that right?
Yes.
But you think it could be a lot older than that?
Currently, we think it's between 10,000 and 80,000 years old.
80,000?
Yes.
80,000. So that's before people arrived in North America.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, the depths of the last ice age. How on earth could it last so long?
Yeah, it's a good question. So one thing that's interesting about this clone, and that is also very common in Aspen clones, is that it's triploid. So that means each chromosome has three copies. So we humans, we have two copies of each chromosome. And usually in Aspen, it's also two copies, which we call diploid. But some clones can get another copy in each cell, which we call triploid. And we also know that triploidy can confer some fitness advantages. So they're going to be better at colonizing. They're going to grow faster. So that could give some of the strength. And
a kind of resilience in depth.
Exactly, yes.
That's so interesting. And I mean, I still want to get my head around this idea that the the wood samples that you were taking were only, 100, maybe 150 years old. Mm-hmm. Maybe the roots are a little bit older.
Yes.
All of the stuff that lived 10,000 years ago has died. And yet you have this sort of shadow, this watermark in the DNA that tells you something of its prehistory.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah. I think it's pretty wonderful. And a lot of these plants can grow clonally like this. So they technically can grow forever, indefinitely. They're technically immortal. And then, of course, you can accumulate mutations that can be deleterious. So the mutations that we look at in the pendoclone are called somatic mutations. And they're the same kind of mutations that would give us cancer. And so that's why it's also interesting that the tree is so old, is that despite accumulating mutations that technically could be deleterious and make the tree die, it's still here.
I mean, I'm sort of thinking of all the changes it would have seen. You say that it's just above a lake, it's in the mountains, it's
yes.
survived through the ice age. Mm-hmm. Is there any way of knowing from either the genes or the wood or the local environment how much change there's been in the environment, in the cold, the hot, the dry, and so on?
Yes, there have been a lot of studies on the geological area, and there was actually a recent study that showed that this particular area was not glaciated. And in the paper, we also have pollen records from the last 60,000 years that show that aspen was present in that area, which supports the results that the pendoclone could have lived for that long.
Rosen Pino, who started the work while at the Georgia Institute of Technology and is now at the University of Chicago. The study is currently a preprint. Find the link on the Science in Action webpage. And sticking with giants of the past, right to the end, a massive tadpole from the time of the dinosaurs. Any tadpole from the Jurassic would be interesting, it turns out. Not the sort of thing I normally worry about. That's because, though fossils of frogs have been found deep into the past, the history of their intermediate larval stage as tadpoles is much shorter. Which raised the idea that frogs once hatched fully formed directly from the egg. So frog specialist Mariana Chuleva of Maimonides University in Argentina was especially pleased when her fellow dinosaur experts brought her this spectacular ancient fossil.
It's not really different of a tadpole you might find in the pond at your backyard, except for the size. It had around 15 or 16 centimeters in length.
And this was just found in a rock in Argentina?
Yes, in Patagonia, in the southernmost part of the country. It was found in a rock from the mid-Jurassic. The geological formation name is La Matilde. And when you see that rock, it's just like a brownish spot on the rock. But then when we saw it under the binocular microscope, we realized that it was a tadpole exquisitely preserved. For example, it has the eyes, the nerves imprints, also the gill skeleton. Even at the limbs are really well preserved, with the fingers and the gut content. I was not in with the team that excavated in this quarry. They were looking for feathered dinosaurs, and they were slicing slabs in this quarry looking for these small dinosaurs, and they were finding hundreds of adult specimens of this frog species. And after several days of excavation, they finally found a tadpole. But as they were looking for dinosaurs, they were not so excited as I was when they brought this fossil to the lab and showed it to me.
Okay, so they said, could you explain this or something? I mean, you were excited because...
Because we didn't know how this ancient frog developed, because some researchers proposed in the past that these frogs had direct development. This means that the frog laid their eggs and then the eggs hatch as a young adult or a juvenile without passing through a tadpole or a larval period. But with this finding, we can say now for sure ancient frogs had a larval stage and they passed through a metamorphosis. So for me, it was amazing to have the first proof that metamorphosis was present in the ancestors of frogs and toads.
So if you go back all these tens of millions of years to 160 or 170 million years or whatever the oldest frog is, you only ever found the mature forms at that point.
Exactly. We only had adults of these frogs.
Why was the tadpole stage invented? If there were frogs being hatched whole from eggs beforehand, what was the advantage of the tadpole stage? Do we know?
Well, that is a highly debated topic among biologists, but one of the main explanations that we have is that the decoupling of the larval stage and the adult stage is somehow useful to split the environment and to exploit the resources in a more efficient way, because larval stage live in the water, they feed in a completely different way than the adults that live in land, and it's insects. So they are not competitors. Also, when you lay the eggs and those are just out of the water immediately as young adults or juveniles, you may have more risk to have predators, and for sure, less eggs will succeed.
Mariana Chuleva reminding us how inventive life can be when it comes to finding ways of staying alive. Go to nature.com for more details of that work, and go to bbcworldservice.com to find our ages-old archive of past editions of Science in Action. It's a monster. I'm Roland Pease. The producer is Alex Mansfield. We've just added one more there, and there will be another next week.